Okay.
He'll get the lights in a second, just go.
So, yeah. The purpose of the talk will be first to discuss transversal gates in color codes and how they work better than we thought. Then I will introduce a more general family of color codes that includes the conventional ones and have very interesting properties. And finally, I want to say something about this notion of single salt fault tolerant and quantum error correction. And no, I will not be talking about self-correction. So, okay. This conference is about local codes, and this talk is about computing locally, in particular in the sense that Jung was discussing yesterday. Okay. So, well, the starting point has to be transversal gates. The aim of transversal gates is to not spread errors by acting on the subsystems that compose the code separately, okay, in such a way that you don't move errors from subsystem to subsystem. So when acting on a certain code block, you will act on each of the subsystems separately, and if acting on several code blocks, you would have gates acting pairwise on these subsystems. Okay, so of course, transversal gates are not enough. We have heard this several times in this conference. Then, well, there are many ways, I guess, to surmount this difficulty, but very general one is magic state distillation with its overhead and so on. And then recently, there were these new approaches. One is gauge fixing, and a main purpose of this talk is to discuss how this can be applied to topological codes. Another one is concatenation of two different codes with different sets of transversal gates that complement each other. Okay, so topological codes are just LDPC codes, local codes, where locality is geometrical. Okay, so our qubits will be in some manifold, and then, yes, our check operators will be local in this geometrical sense. And well, I mean, I don't have to defend them here, but basically, I think they are very appealing to a physicist because they are so connected in many ways to physics, to statistical physics, to condensed matter physics, and so on. Yesterday, we also heard about this result, about restrictions on transversal gates on topological codes, depending on dimension. We will be able, or at most, to implement gates on topological stabilized codes that belong in two dimensions to the Clifford group, in three dimensions to some other set. And then each of these sets will include this phase gate, okay, where the phase is smaller as the dimension increases. And I will show that with color codes, you can actually implement each of these guys at every dimension so that you saturate somehow this bounding up, at least in this weak sense of finding some gate that is in, accessible in 3D but not in 2D and so on. So this would be analog to what John was discussing for real Müller codes yesterday. So again, coming back to yesterday's talk, so we have this notion of, well, Sergey was calling them topologically protected gates, or I just want to call them local operations. The idea is to have some finite depth circuit such that the involved processes at each level are local. Okay, so with such a process, errors will not be able to spread very far away. There will be some sort of cone, causal cone, and we will be good in terms of if the locality of our code like matches the locality of the process. So more generally, I want to consider processes where quantum operations are local in this sense, but we allow for classical processing that is global. Okay, so maybe in the first level I do some quantum operation and I get some outcomes, and then I use this information to implement between different choices of local processes in the second level. So of course, this is dangerous in terms of errors because it could give rise to non-local errors if you are not. So still, we will see that this class of processes is interesting, and I think also it could be interesting to use this as some sort of operational definition for a class of local codes, you know, that you can, where you can do error correction through such a process, or maybe like initialize your states with such a process or such a thing. So for example, this would be true, you know, for any topological stabilizer codes, or in general for abelian onion systems, but not for non-abelian ones. So somehow, you know, it could provide like some class that is intermediate in difficulty between these. So I think, well, just mentioned this, I think it could be interesting to explore. Okay. But this talk is about color codes. So what is special about color codes is that they put together that they are topological and they allow you to do nicely transversal gates. So originally, we introduced them in two dimensions with the aim of getting the Clifford group, and then, well, you can do magic state distillation to recover universality. In higher dimensions, as I was saying, you can recover this phase gate, and in particular in 3D, you get this T gate, and by using an ancillary encoded state in the plus state, which is easy to prepare, you can recover the Hadamard and universality. Okay, so just in passing, I mentioned these recent experiments where they demonstrated in an ion trap that, well, basically the preparation and playing around with such a 7-qubit code, or which is also like the simplest color code. Okay. Good. So several bad things about color codes in different degrees of badness. Not so bad that we thought that there exist constraints on the kind of color lattice that you can consider. So for example, in two dimensions, we thought that you needed to have like lattices that only involve plaquettes with four vertices or eight vertices and so on. Then more importantly, if you go to three dimensions, the check operators for some of the check operators are actually involve many qubits, okay? Involve dozens of qubits, which is pretty bad. And then finally, there is this need for the ancilla encoded states in three dimensions also. So today I want to show first that these constraints on the geometry are irrelevant. Okay, so all color codes on a given dimension will give you the same transversal gates. Then by going into these generalized gates, color codes, it's possible to make measurements much more local. So now we will be okay with just measuring 4 or 6 qubit operators. And thanks to the gauge fixing trick, it's possible to get rid of the need for any ancilla encoded states for getting the Hadamard. In fact, we are going to get it transversally. As a bonus, turns out that these codes have some weird feature that you can do fault tolerant quantum error correction without having to repeat your measurements. So that is that somehow, even if you have, so the syndrome extraction process is somehow robust to having syndrome errors. And because of this, it's possible to do everything, initialization, gates, error correction in constant time. So basically you have no time overhead. Well, except for the classical operations, okay, that I'm assuming are immediately. You can do it immediately, which is not really true, and of course, as you scale.
You still need multiple error correction cycles, right?
Yeah. I'm just saying that. So, okay. So, in a conventional topological code, if you don't do repeated measurements, you are not going to get a useful syndrome, right? But here, you could actually, in just a single step, you can reduce your noise to a level that is acceptable.
Energy is high.
No, this is no energy thing. This will be just, you know, active error correction. It's just that somehow the syndrome recovery process is robust. Okay. We will see exactly how this it's very physical. Okay. So let's start with color codes, and let's start with the easiest, with two dimensions. This will be a bit redundant with previous talks, but very fast. So we have this kind of lattices where the vertices are trivalent. Okay, so we have three links meeting at this vertex, and plaquettes are tricolorable. We put one qubit at each vertex, and there is going to be two stabilizer generators per plaquette. One is a product of X, and the other a product of C. So we have a self-dual CSS scope. Depending on the global geometry, okay, we will have a different number of encoded qubits. This is just the usual topological degeneracy thing. And the most convenient geometry is such a triangular geometry where its boundary is different. So this boundary involves only green and red plaquettes. This one involves red and blue plaquettes, and so on. So this way we can attach a color with this boundary. And for such a geometry, you know, independent of details, you always get one encoded qubit. And the logical operators take a particularly simple form, which is just, you know, a product of all the X operators or all the C operators. Okay. And this will be true, actually, in higher dimensions. So the support of undetectable errors will be a string-like. And the idea is that such errors will have to connect the three sides of the triangle, so that they always have this global nature. Okay, you cannot find a local error that satisfies this constraint. Okay, so because these are self-dual CSS codes, we automatically get CNOT gates, Hadamard gates, transversally. Then more tricky is to recover this gate that I'm calling R2. I think you call it S or just the Clifford phase gate. And this gate, well, maybe just going to the geometry, if you apply this gate to each of the qubits in the code, what will happen is that generally you are going to go out of the code space. So those plaquettes that have a number of qubits that is multiple of 4 will stay with no syndrome, but those that are, you know, like have 6 qubits, 10 qubits, and so on, will become excited if you want. They will have a negative syndrome. So then what you could do is, for example, in this case, okay, I apply this transversal gate, and then I get this syndrome. So there is always some product of C operators that I can apply. In this case, just applying a C here, that will take me back to the code subspace. And indeed, you know, if you think of doing first the R2 gate and then Z, this amounts to doing the inverse gate. And what happens is that, well, you can check easily that actually this will still give you the action that you want on the logical operator. So it will give you an encode R2 gate. Okay. So this way you can get rid of these constraints where you have to have only like octagons and squares and so on. Okay. So, well, the trick works very, very simply in two dimensions. In higher dimensions, it's much more involved, but at least in 2D, you can see it directly. Okay. So before going to higher dimension, it's good to take a dual perspective on the 2D lattice so that we think in terms of color vertices that corresponds to the plaquettes. And now the qubits, all vertices will correspond to triangles. Okay, so we have some simplicial lattice that is tricolorable. And this is convenient, well, for many reasons, it's convenient to go to higher dimensions, and also in order to design codes, you know, like the picture for the 7-qubit code is just like a simplex, and so on. So actually, it gives you a simpler, or it gives you a better tool to construct them. Not so. However, it's still better to visualize the code, of course, in the direct picture where qubits correspond to vertices. Like here, it would be very obscure. So here, qubits correspond first to this triangle and then to each of these links and the vertices. Okay. So going to higher dimensions, instead of a triangular lattice, we will have some simplicial lattice. Instead of being three colorable, it will be D plus one colorable, where this is the spatial dimension. The geometry before the global geometry was this triangle. Now in three dimensions will be a tetrahedra and so on, right? So again, it has this simplicial global geometry. the qubits will be in the simplices, meaning that in the direct lattice, still they will correspond to vertices. And then for this kind of geometry, the logical operators are still this product of all the x's or all the z's. Okay? So for a given spatial dimension and a given lattice, we can still choose different different codes. This is just like in the case of a toric code in different dimensions. So we can choose the dimension basically of our say z logical operator. So for example, in three dimensions, we could have extremes or we could have membranes. And then for x logical operators, we will have the dual dimension. Okay, so the stabilizers will go with objects that are one dimension smaller. So for the case of strings here, I will have vertices, and here membranes, I will have links, okay, in this simplicial picture. So remember, okay, so in three dimensions, in particular, okay, so we can construct families of codes that are somehow analog to the two-dimensional case, in that the each of the sides of the tetrahedra will correspond to the actually to the two-dimensional code family that we saw. In the simplest case, we recover the 15-qubit code, the Rothmüller code. And then, okay, so in three dimensions, so we're saying, so the idea would be that we can have either X stabilizers related to vertices and C stabilizers related to links, or dual. Big difference is that the links only involve 4 or 6 qubits, whereas these guys involve up to 24 qubits in a suitably chosen lattice, which is actually a BCC lattice, where each of the square lattices or cubic lattices contains one of these two colors. So yeah, just a reminder, in three dimensions, vertices in the dual lattice correspond to cells in the direct lattice. Particularly, if you are familiar with 3D color codes, you are used to this picture. Similarly, the plaquettes correspond to the links. Okay, just a reminder. So, in order to implement transversal gates on these arbitrary dimensions, we will use the following trick. So for such a CSS code with such logical operators, we can implement this phase gate Rn, where this is the 2 to the n root of unity. So we can implement it with several copies of the same gate on each of the qubits if my x stabilizers satisfy some conditions. So the idea is that I take the support out of each of the generators for the X stabilizers. And then I check whether each of these generators has a weight that is 0 mod 2 to the n, whether each intersection has a weight that is 0 mod 2 to n minus 1, and so on. So we take large, intersections of more and more supports of generators, and then this the module goes down steadily. Okay, and these are the conditions we need to satisfy. Now, I will use a slightly different trick, where in some of the qubits I apply this Rn gate several times, and then I apply the inverse to the other qubits. Okay, so I have two different sets of qubits, black and white. And now the condition looks like this. Okay, so now it's about the difference between the intersections involving the black qubits and then the intersections involving the white qubits. Okay, so
can you go back to that?
Yes.
Okay, so it just always generalizes with the hollow one at the end. Okay, sorry.
When you want to check if this works for color codes, something that helps you a lot is that, okay, so you need to work out these intersections of generators, okay? But because of the color structure, these intersections will be very constrained. So if you have an arbitrary lattice and you take the intersection of, say, two plaquettes, the intersection could be, say, a vertex, for example, okay? But in the color code, depending on the dimension, there will be restrictions. So for example, in three dimensions, the intersection of two cells always have to be, you know, a plaquette or several plaquettes, but it couldn't be just like a link or a vertex, okay? So this constrains you a lot and helps you a lot. And then, so I will not show it, it's a bit non-trivial, at least with the proof that I have. But the idea is that, again, in order to choose, so remember, we have these black qubits and white qubits, so in order to choose these sets, we're going to look at the plaquettes, okay? So as in the 2D case, there are the good plaquettes, the ones that are multiples of 4 in terms of number of qubits, and the bad plaquettes. So the bad plaquettes, I will suppose that they have, you know, a syndrome corresponding to this bad plaquette, okay, which is possible, first of all. And then I will find some error, you know, correction operator for that syndrome. And the support of that operator will give me the set that I have to use. This sounds mysterious, but it actually works. So by doing so, you find that the only constraint in order to get the transversal gates is this dimensional, okay? So here, n labels the phase gate, so the larger the n, the smaller the phase. D, remember, the small d, or lowercase d, labels the instance of the code. So the smaller instance would be when this is 1, it corresponds to a string operators. And then this is the spatial dimension, that in order to implement this Rn will have to be larger than this product. Okay, so at least it will have to be larger than n, and this saturates the bound of Sergey and Robert. Okay, so this is the...
I don't think I understand this. You're saying that there's a solution to this set of equations that you have in the previous slide. If capital D is greater than or equal to little n times little d, but you have the example where n is like 15 for the quantum Reed-Muller code and d is 3.
N is labeling the gate. So n, I'm trying to implement this.
Is the root of unity that...
So 2 to the n.
I see. Okay. And d is...
And little d labels the code. So it labels the dimension of the logical operators of, say... So in this case, it's... What? C operator? Well, either C or X. I don't know. Like one of these. So...
Little d is the dimension of the object that you define the X-type checks of the code. Is that what you're saying?
So it's the dimension of the logical operator. So, it would be... So in two dimensions, it will be always 1, because we always have strings. Okay, in two dimensions, it could be 1 or 2. But the
it doesn't matter that you also have d minus 1?
No, so the thing is that, I mean, what matters for the trick is say the x side, right? So in the end, this will give you this constraint. Yeah, I mean, they are tight. So, I mean. So here, there is no choice. If you have d, you have... Oh, you mean... No. I thought you were talking about duality. But anyways... So yeah, that.
Oh, I was. You take d to be the minimum of the support dimension.
No, so I'm saying that first you choose d, and then you have this constraint, and then the most favorable case is taking small d equal to 1. But then, if you want to have self-correction, mm-hmm. you need to take it higher,
sure.
Right? And this is what happened to us when we had these Lexis dimensional codes. Okay.
So in that previous set of equations, you said those are the X-type. Checks for the code. Does that mean that little d has to be the spatial dimension of the x type checks of the
code? Okay, so we have to go back and see what I say here. So a small d corresponds to dimension of c logical operators.
Okay, these are the diamonds. Okay.
Can you repeat what you were saying about the green plaquette that has an odd or?
Yeah, so there are these bad plaquettes, okay? And then it is possible, it's not obvious, right, that there is an error syndrome that corresponds to those bad plaquettes.
So when you do
this would be for a code where you actually take the plaquettes to be stabilizers, right? So you take that code, and then because the constraints that satisfy the syndrome, okay, and it's somehow the same. It's mathematically, it's isomorphic to the constraints that satisfy this oddness of the plaquettes. Okay. I mean, I can show you, but then we will be like, actually, I'm late already. So.
Okay. Can I just check it? So, in actual fact, this picture at the top, two cubes that are colored in this way.
No. I didn't have.
I understand the point of the picture, but they can't actually intersect, right?
No, they can't. Okay. They can't. No,
that's
it's just. I couldn't. I don't have the original file, so I cannot.
Okay.
I'm bad with storage. Anyways. So, yeah. I don't know any other questions. So I just wanted to state the result because, I get the proof.
But sorry, I still don't fully get the green picture. The point is that when you apply your transversal...
So the thing is that you find this error that will give you this syndrome, okay? This I tell you can do.
You measure the syndrome of the...
No. This is abstraction. No. I'm just saying we want to find a set, okay? We want to find black qubits and white qubits, okay? So I'm just saying, if you choose them so that there is an odd number of whites in the bad plaquettes and an even number of ones in the good plaquettes, by magic, okay, like it's really magic, you actually, if I plan, you know, either this gate or the inverse to black and white, you will get the desired gate. But it's not obvious at all. Not obvious at all, okay? Unless it is obvious and I don't know why. Okay, enough of that. Gauge color codes. So fortunately, John explained yesterday what is a subsystem code. We have this gauge subsystem about which we don't care. And in order to define it, we introduce a gauge group such that its center is the stabilizer. Okay, so this gauge group only acts on these gauge qubits. Then you distinguish between bear and rest operators. Bear operators commute with all the gauge generators so that, you know, they only act on logical qubits. And then dress ones only commute with the stabilizer, so they actually act here. So from the error correction point of view, the dress ones are the most important, right? Because you are going to be able to check whether, you know, what happened with the stabilizers after the action of the error. So the way gauge color codes are defined is simply by introducing two parameters. Okay, instead of just one parameter, we have two, so that now we can choose the dimensions separately of the dress logical operators for C and for X. Okay, this is the difference. Before they were related by duality, and now not. Okay, so then bare logical operators will be somehow dual in their dimensionality, and well, we have now these dimensions for the objects involved. So it's better to go for an example. So in three dimensions.
E-bar and E-bar are also constrained, the same?
So this notation just means dual.
Okay.
So it's just the dual, yeah. So the only parameters are D and E. And there is this constraint that together the sum cannot be larger than this. So
when you say dimensions, it means the X stabilizer generator has weight D minus 1? Or what does that mean?
So this would be, for example, if D is 1, this would mean that zero-dimensional objects vertices give you the S stabilizer.
Yeah,
okay.
No, not the weight. You mean the dimensionality of the objects.
I see.
Mm-hmm. So there is this constraint, and with it is when you saturate it, you recover the conventional codes. Okay. So in particular in 3D, in the conventional case, the stabilizer and the gauge group are the same, and then we have this, like, you know, dual picture where we have vertices and links, or links and vertices. Now in the gauge version, we could have vertices and vertices. Okay, so this means that dress logical operators will be strings and strings, which is kind of weird, right? For anybody that is familiar with the condensed matter picture. And so gauge operators will go with links. Now this is a big deal because these guys have a much smaller weight, and also now we have self-duality. Okay, so now we have X and Z playing the same role, and we recover a transversal Hadamard. Okay, this will be very important. So, how we recover the stabilizer from the syndrome from what I'm going to call the gauge syndrome? Okay, so I'm going to measure these gauge generators, the links, and I want to get the syndrome that is related to the vertices. So. At every vertex, we have several links incoming. This picture does not correspond to any real case, okay, just an abstraction. Okay, so in order to to recover the value of this stabilizer generator, I need is enough to measure any of the so for example all the links that go to red vertices from this one. Okay, so if there is an odd number of links with minus eigenvalue, okay, or if you want, let me say excited links. So if there is an odd number of excited links, then this will be also excited. It will have a minus eigenvalue. If they are even, it will be plus. This means that there is a constraint, because I said that I can do this for each color, right? So this means that either all of them will be even or all of them will be odd, okay, for each color. So this is a sort of Gauss law, okay? So we have this Gauss law where there is some flux conservation at its vertex. Okay.
Can you recap the gauge are the edges, right?
Yeah.
So you're measuring the edges.
Yes.
Should I imagine that there's a qubit at each end of the edge?
No.
These are not
the qubits. Yeah.
Right?
So the qubits are very bad to see in the dual picture because they are the higher dimensional objects. They are the simplest.
But
right.
What does it correspond to in the original picture? And so you have
vertices.
You have,
oh, so this would be a plaquette.
These links are plaquettes, right? So you're measuring
so
instead of the whole cube, you're measuring it. In
the picture is here. So
plaquettes.
Yeah. So the picture is there. So this is our cell, and you know the gauge corresponds to each of these.
So you
measure
these brackets.
Yeah, and then the stabilizer would correspond to the whole object.
Yes.
Right. But the thing is that each color independently will give us all the information. So there is this constraint. Okay. So there is a nice interpretation for this constraint. And to reveal it, let me draw. Okay, so now, okay, I measure the syndrome. Okay, the syndrome are the gauge syndrome, sorry, which are these links. And then I have this picture where imagine I draw all the links that are excited, that have this minus sigma. Okay? And when the link is, say, green and blue, I will attach to it red and yellow color, so the complementary colors. So if I do it that way, what will happen is that, well, first of all, there is going to be a conservation of these fluxes, okay? So they cannot just end. And in addition, they might have branching points, but these branching points, because of this constraint that I mentioned, will be
can
such that.
Sorry, can you repeat this constraint?
The constraint is that.
About how to
yes. So the constraint is that. The okay. Either here there is an say a particle or not. Okay. So if there is a particle, there will be an odd number of excited links of this type, like green and blue. Okay. If there is no, it will be even, and this will be for each color independently.
I see.
So with this kind of coloring, so the reason to choose this complementary coloring is so that we have color conservation. So you can see that at each branching point, we have incoming yellow, outgoing yellow, incoming green, outgoing green, and so on. So it's kind of nice. So then you have like, you know, color flux conservation or something.
I'm sorry, I'm not kidding. the dots are syndrome objects.
Yeah.
Okay, and the lines are gauge
syndromes.
Objects.
Yeah, gauge syndromes.
Gauge syndrome objects. Okay. They're not necessarily points and lines like we're seeing here, but they're objects in whatever dimension we're talking about.
Okay, I'm omitting, you know, I'm not depicting all the vertices and all the links. I'm just depicting those that are excited.
Okay.
In this picture,
the ones that have
negative eigenvalue.
I see. Okay, fine. They're the syndrome bits or whatever that we see.
Yeah.
Fine. The coloring that we ascribe to the gauge objects is the complementary color of the pairs. They're always line-like in that they connect a pair of syndrome objects so that you can come up with a, but this is just D equals 3, I guess.
Yes.
So it really is, you're just lines and
yes.
dots.
Yes, I'm just working out the three-dimensional case critique because it's so important. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, imagine.
So they don't all, I mean, they don't all commute, these gauge operators.
No, but these are only because.
A few colors and they still.
The thing is that I'm just doing either the X measurements or the Z measurements.
Yeah, you're just making a choice and then you have a pattern of.
Exactly. So that's why I can talk about gauge syndrome, right? It wouldn't make sense otherwise.
So the strings aren't determined, they're not deterministically.
They are random.
Random
pattern. So basically, given the, you know, given some syndrome, you could get any collection that has the right branching points. So in particular, in the ground state, in the cold star space, there is no branching point, so you only find loops. Okay.
So in the 2D color codes, you've been given a color to the line segments between vertices using the third color that isn't the pair of color of the two vertices. But you sometimes have to walk through the faces as well. So if I have two distantly, if that red and blue, let's say, vertex are distantly separated and are not connected by just a single gauge link, how do I create a connected
color? No, this means that here there will be many links that
many
are excited.
Links, but is it only links? That's the question.
Yeah, it's only links.
We had to sometimes walk through faces.
No. So this is why I chose to this like dual picture. So for many things, it's so much more convenient. Okay. So for visualizing, this is it's completely straightforward. You just have the links and that's it.
It's just the
links. It's like a
Okay.
But for a given error pattern, these branching points really are
fixed.
Invariant.
Yes.
But when I measure, I can get lots of different possibilities to get those branching.
Yeah. That's why I try to. The picture is like very convoluted, right?
Very artsy.
So
all of these big spots, they correspond to like lit up syndromes, right? What will a trivial syndrome look like? Is it just nothing with nothing?
Yeah, there is no, when there is no branching point.
I want an easier picture. Just nothing.
Yeah.
Okay. So you'll have loops.
John will be unhappy with you because I will not be able to explain the. Well, okay.
So the decoding algorithm is given a collection of points, find the minimum weight colored string net that connects them all together where the coloring is consistent with the, like you said here.
Sorry, what?
So if you're...
Oh, no. So the errors... So given these syndromes, there will be some dress operators that are like the minimum error that will give this syndrome, right?
Yes.
This is a different picture. This is a different picture. So actually, I'm not giving it to you. So... You know that they are line-like objects, okay? And they are connected in some sense, okay? But they don't correspond to this link picture. So this is, it's different. So these are different things. These are different things, and it's important. But the thing is that the logical operators are string operators. Logical and the error operators you can interpret as strings, okay?
Okay.
So for example, okay, so... Also important is that, given some dimension, some lattice, we have all these different codes, and they are related by some partial ordering. Okay. So in terms of like this containment either of the stabilizer or of the gates. So the idea is that, in two dimensions I only have 1, 1. Then in three dimensions I always also have, so these are D and E, right? So these are strings and membranes and strings. So this would be, these three cases would be the three-dimensional case. Then in four dimensions, we also have these guys, 1, 3, 2, 2, 1, 3, 1. And there is this partial ordering and this arrow. So the arrows tell me that any encoded state here can be immediately interpreted as being an encoded state here. Okay, because logical operators are the same. Okay. Then to go the other way around is when we use this gauge fixing technique. Okay. So in the abstract, this will amount to measure some stabilizer generators and applying some gauge elements to fix the gates, and this will require some non-local classical computation, but let me go to 3D.
I'm sorry, could you say again what the arrows represent?
Oh yes, so it's just this partial orders, which is basically such that when you go down the arrow, you can interpret any encoded state here as being encoded here. So if I have in three dimensions a conventional color code, okay, involving strings and membranes, I can immediately regard it as one involving only strings. I'm just forgetting some of the information. Okay. This is what I'm doing. Okay. So to see how the gauge fixing works, I prefer to go to a three-dimensional case. So if we are going to go from maybe this is not very. let me go. So if you are in an encoded state, and you are in this 1-1 gauge color code in 3D, right? So if you measure these gauge generators, okay, say for X or whatever, you will get only closed loops. Okay, they have no branching points. And then such closed loops can be annihilated by using plaquette operators, okay, which are themselves like gauge generators. And then by doing this, you will go, if you want, to this vacuum where there are no loops. This you can do either for X or for C, but not for both. And this way, you are going to go up either of these two arrows. OK? So that's gauge fixing. That's gauge fixing in this picture. It's like removing the loops. Okay. Now, with this trick, we can actually do all gates transversally. So in the gates color code in 3D, I can implement CNodes and Hadamards. Then I fix the gates to apply this the phase gate, the T gate, and then immediately I'm back to the gate code. So if I do all my error correction here, and you know, for the gate fixing, I only need to measure gate generators, which are also six local. So all my measurements will stay six local, and I'm good. Okay. So the only thing that you could be suspicious is, you know, could there be problems in doing this gate fixing? What happens when there are errors? Blah blah blah, and so on. But this will come later on. But you know, at least in the you can see in the for encoded states, you can see that this will work.
Six local is because they're cubes and these are the faces?
Because the plaquettes are all either hexagons or squares in a certain lattice. So there exists such a code.
Okay.
There exists such a code.
As you have described. Right.
If there is time, I will show it to you in the end of the talk.
Okay.
I don't know. So I will finish with this. No more questions. Yes. OK. And then I jump finally to this notion of single shot fault tolerance and error correction, but actually I will not. So I will just describe something simpler, conceptually simpler, this initialization that is single shot and fault tolerance, OK? Which, because it already shows what is special about these codes. OK, so going back to this effectively local operations, by using them, we can initialize, if we have like perfect such effective local operation, we can initialize and encode zero in a say toric code just by starting with this tensor product with where all of the qubits are in the zero state. Then we measure our X generators, we get some syndrome, you know, some random, completely random syndrome. And then we just find, this is the classical computation part, we just find some strings that connect these syndromes and apply them, and this way remove the these particles. Okay, so it doesn't really matter which strings we choose, because you know, C logical errors will not affect this state. So the choice is immaterial, okay, and this is very useful. But what if there is noise? So if there is noise, if I do just like say one round of measurements, I'm going to get some ghost syndromes that are not really there. Okay. So now if I apply my error correction procedure, I will end up with some state where these ghost syndromes became actual syndromes. Okay. And importantly, you can see that in general, like these strings will be large. So let me see, let me explain the setting that we have here. So as I was saying, the applied correction is immaterial up to, you know, stabilizer or logical C operators. Then in order to go to the meat of the problem, I only want to assume that the only thing that fails in my procedure is the readings. Okay, so the syndrome that I get is not correct. And it will not be correct in a local way. So you know, if a number of given syndromes will be wrong with a probability that is exponentially suppressed. Okay, this is my condition. So it will be local noise in this sense. And I will get some effective error. So I can attach to a given wrong syndrome. Okay. To some. Okay, so also I'm assuming that the errors in the syndrome reading are independent of the actual syndrome. Okay, to simplify. So with that setting up to every set of wrong measurements, I can attach some error operator that will kill that syndrome. Okay, and I can choose this arbitrarily because of this immaterial nature. So effectively, for you know, there is some probability for these wrong measurements, and this will give me some probability for this for this effective error that I'm introducing because of the worms. Okay, so I'm just saying I start with some probability for worm measurements and I end up with some probability for errors. Okay, and I can choose the error just as long as it has the right thing. Now, the question is, if I do this, like, you know, in this kind of single shot, will the effective error model will it be local also? Okay, so here I was arguing that for the Tory code it would not be true because, you know, a few ghosts will give rise to this like very real.
You have some freedom in choosing those errors.
Yes.
You take them to optimize locality.
Yes. Yeah. You're so tough that yeah, I love it. Anyways, so yeah, so let's go to Gates color codes and see how it works.
So it's true that you can measure just the X checks of the code and identify Z errors, and the Z errors have no consequence in the encoded zero that you're trying to compare. But why don't you also measure the Z checks, which could identify X errors that might happen during that same time step?
No, okay. So I'm simplifying, you know, as much as possible. So I'm isolating the source of errors that, okay, so, you know, all quantum operations are local, so they will only give rise to, you know, this kind of local errors. But the problem is really in the non-local part, the classical part, and the problems will be coming from having these wrong measurements. Okay, so if you look at a phenomenological model, what will matter, I mean, we can discuss this, but what will matter is this. Okay, so I'm just reducing the problem, you know, as much as possible to see what is really going on.
Okay, so if you only ever measure the X checks and there's Z errors, who cares? You're just trying to prepare a logical zero state. If they, you know, we don't care. Overall phase, you know, doesn't really have consequence for that state. So,
I mean, I'm just removing from the picture like local source of errors. I'm just trying to analyze like, what could be like a global source of errors. let me explain it. So again, we are going to measure. So either X or Z. Gate generators, and this will give me the syndrome from the branching points. So this will be completely random, and also the syndrome will be completely random. So I will have like somebody involved reading. And the thing is that some of these gauge measurements will be wrong. Okay, so maybe I have here a closed loop that is actually a ghost, and here I have these like loops with branches with branching points that is also a ghost. So I am simplifying, again, although later maybe I can discuss this, in that I'm going to only accept valid, I'm going to assume that my error model says that it only gives me valid syndromes, okay? So not syndromes that have endpoints, right? Because there is this flux conservation. But this is not important. Okay, this is just to simplify the discussion. So the thing is that, yeah, we can have this ghost. So this ghost, for example, would be irrelevant because it doesn't create any ghost particles, but this one will give rise to two ghost syndromes. Okay, so I can attach to such a ghost collection of fluxes, I can attach an error that will be comparable in size to the flux. So here, okay, so this guy is composed of links. All of these links went wrong, right? And then the error operator that gives me these two syndromes has a support that is, you know, up to a constant, smaller than the flux. Okay, this is important. So you can see already like some very big difference with the surface code. So then the idea. So what we need to do is to take any set of qubits and say, okay, what is the chance that I'm getting an error involving all of these qubits? Okay, so I have to consider all such ghost configurations that would give rise to an error that contains these guys. Okay, and the thing is that such ghosts will have to be large enough. Okay, they will have to be comparable to this.
So
and
where are the faulty? Where is the ghost?
So these are the wrong measurements.
OK, that's the red.
These are some wrong syndromes. And then this is part of the error. Yeah,
possible,
the error that I choose. And then these guys here are the ones that I, you know, I'm just trying to bound the total, you know, the total probability that there will be an error in all of these guys. OK? And for that, I need to sum over all these diagrams. So they are all connected. okay? And they have a size that is, you know, at least comparable to this. And then you just use the usual counting arguments, and you show that actually the total probability is exponentially suppressed in the size of this. Okay, that's the trick.
But only if you don't have any loops in the original state that you before the measurement, right?
No. So
because if you have proliferation of loops,
no. So
some of them could be actually part of the loop, and then you put the words.
What matters? So remember the Tory code. What matters is the wrong syndromes, right?
Yeah.
So here, what matters is the wrong, you know, gauge syndrome and the wrong proper syndrome that you get out of it. Little it matters all the rest
can
of stuff.
Can I say that you have an overcomplete set of gauge operators with local checks? They satisfy some local constraints, which is local products. So you effectively have a code for which you use to correct it.
Yeah. Something like that.
Except the gauge strings are random.
Yeah. Okay, but, you know. Well, I don't know. So basically, the reasoning is contained here. So I don't know if this is clear. I mean, it's all about connectedness, okay? And it's all about connectedness, really.
So would this same argument then apply to the 4D?
Yes. No. Well, I will say something.
Okay.
Okay. So more or less, you buy this, and then. Okay, so I omitted this problem where actually the gauge syndrome will not be valid. Okay, in general, I will get some random errors, and then of course they will have endpoints. So when I do my gauge syndrome measurement, I will get all this like mess of loops all around the place, and there will be some endpoints. So on the endpoints, these are fixed. This is the only information that I actually have. So now I find the smallest gauge syndrome errors that could give rise to such endpoints, okay? So this is just trying to correct for this like invalidity of the syndrome. So in doing so, imagine that the real errors that happened were this, okay? And then I all I can see, because remember there is like a here like this mess of, because I cannot really see this, right? All I see is the branching points and the these endpoints. This all the information that I actually have.
Sorry,
how can you tell apart the branching point from an endpoint? Because both are a foundation of Gauss. No. For a moment, you shocked me. No. So, no. Look, one thing is kinematic. Okay? So, non-valid syndromes don't exist. Don't exist. Whereas branching points are configurations. So they constrain the how the fluxes can be, but you know it's different things. So it's two level of constraint. One is, I don't know how to say, non-kinematical, and the other one is really kinematical. So this thing cannot exist. Okay. So what I'm saying is that remember, like here there will be some mess of excited loops and whatever, but the information that I really get is the branching points and these endpoints. So the endpoints is the first thing that I have to correct. I say, so this is the part where you say I'm doing error correction for the gauge syndrome. Effectively, that's true. So in the sense that I'm looking for the smallest.
By valid means it obeys the Gauss law, although
yes.
it's a wrong syndrome.
It
obeys the Gauss law.
Exactly.
And non-valid is it doesn't obey the Gauss law.
Exactly. Yeah. So first thing you need to, okay, this is in the Tory code. If you have like the torus and you get an odd number of particles, you know something went wrong. Okay, so this is the same. That's not a valid syndrome. The difference that here, you know, little you can do in the Tory code when you are faced with that. But here, you can do something. So you find the smallest, gauge syndrome errors that would give rise to such endpoints. So in this particular case, now I'm God and I can see like what happened. So I can see that these guys went wrong. Okay, but I thought that these guys went wrong. So overall, I'm going to get like this net wrong measurements, okay? And then I'm back to the original picture because the number of errors here is at least, you know, at most half of the total size of this thing, okay? So still this will be suppressed with half of its length. So the total object will be still be exponentially suppressed. Okay? So that's important. So that's how you still can do the same.
You said this was initialization, but isn't it the same protocol for error correction?
Well, but not the explanation. So the thing is that I used, there was this point where I said, oh, I can choose the error that I attach to the syndrome. So to actually give you the argument for fault tolerance is more involved. The protocol is the same, but the reasoning, I wanted to give you like a simple reasoning that makes sense, okay?
And the decoding is efficient?
Yes, because it is. This is just matching. I mean, it wouldn't be optimal, but you know, it's efficient.
Can I ask? I'm pretty sure I understand how you detect a branching point, but these points, it's not clear because I mean, you measure your gate generator; it's all random. How do I detect an endpoint like this? I mean,
So there is because you check the constraint.
I mean, David, you can see the strings.
You do see.
You do see the strings. It's violation of the gauge.
It's just there are this like highly fluctuating object, right? It's like, but
it's
the
just,
thing.
It's just that because they're violation of gauge conditions, they don't really mean anything about the code.
Right. Okay. They're all over the place.
Yeah. So you see them all over the place, but if they break, that's something that couldn't be able to happen.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Hmm. Okay. So connecting to self-correction. For the Tory code and so on. In typical, at least in the self-correcting stylized code that I know, what happens is that the syndromes are connected objects. Okay, so there will be a string-like or membrane-like or something. Then, because of this, you can easily see that you know now you are going to measure directly. You know, this is just a stabilizer code, not a subsystem code, and you are going to get directly the you know this error syndrome, but for example, in the initialization procedure, the idea is that you are going to create only small loops. Okay, so it's not so much small errors, but small syndromes. Okay, and that's good enough. This I'm saying I will not discuss it, but that's good enough. So you don't need a local error model in the usual sense, but just if your syndromes are exponentially suppressed, like in this sense, like this object, then.
Is it true that you're showing that if you have low-weight syndromes, it corresponds to low-weight error?
The thing is that the error is a bit different because it will correspond to some larger object. So what I'm saying is that if you're... Okay, so you will have some error model, okay? And you are trying to keep... you have some parameter...
It's a low-weight error that it can be responsible for.
Yes, but it's it will be, for example, here it will be quadratic. It will be, quadratic in the syndrome length.
Okay, but they may syndrome of weight k, and then the error is, so it scales with k.
Yeah, But I'm saying that you don't even need to care because all that matters is that these guys remain small, which in the self-correcting picture is very obvious, right? But the thing is that for fault tolerance you can also think this way. It's enough to keep your syndromes very small.
Instead of trying to match the broken gauge strings with each other, can't we use a sort of self-correction idea to come up with a local decoder that just tries to shrink the broken gauge strings back to the points that are supposed to obey the Gauss law, and then that
gauge
string just disappears?
I don't know what you mean.
So local, sort of have like a local elastic force, if you will. So you locally look and see if you see a half broken and half not broken, then you shrink the.
But you mean for the endpoints? Not for the or for the branching points.
No, for the ones with the blue X's on them, the previous.
Yeah, so those don't exist. So I mean,
right.
No.
And if you wanted to just nudge the branching points, you'd need global information to know which way to move.
Yeah.
I see. I thought they existed. And you would walk your way down. I thought that's what you were trying to match was these blue X's.
So there are two levels. First, you match.
You are. Yeah.
But if you go back to the branching points, then you'll have some color conservation. Remember his earlier picture, he had branching at different colors. And different
I see. So that would be fine.
If you remove one of them, it doesn't become just a loop.
Okay, so actually, for gauge fixing, we are going to need this. Okay. Because remember, we have these loops and we want to take them to the vacuum. We will never make it to the vacuum, but we will make it close. So what we are going to do is, you know, just suppose you are in an encoded state, then you are going to manage to get some small loops. And then in doing the transversal gate, because this transversal gate respects the causal space, but doesn't just say commute or anti-commute with the stabilization units. It's different. So what will happen is that these small error syndromes will give rise through the gate randomly to some, you know, particles, dual particles appearing around the stream. Okay, so you can see that as long as this guy is small, also this will be small, and still you are good. So that's the thing. So this way you can actually do effectively transversal, let me call it, gate in constant time. So you can do everything in constant time. So initialize, error correct, gates. So somehow you get this notion of local or general, well, let me say local gates, not transversal. So you get these local gates, but are not so local. They have this non-local classical computation, but still somehow the system is robust so that you are not going to do too bad by introducing this non-locality. Okay. Okay, so summary. Well, we saw that 3D gauge color codes have many surprising features. Then, important questions would be, which are the error thresholds? I suspect the thresholds should be better, also because of the single shot property, but should be better than for conventional color codes in many ways. Then we should wonder, you know, what are the real limitations in terms of this kind of construction in two dimensions? So we know very well stabilizer codes, but you know, there are these intermediate families, and then, you know, what can we do? Because 3D is not really so good in many ways. Then, well, I wonder, what if you drop out this topological nature of the codes and look for something that, you know, can do these same tricks, but, you know, with some non-geometrical locality. And finally, well, we got this connection between self-correction and single shot fault tolerance. And we'll see this, all these pictures of these particles that are linked by these fluxes and these walls. So I was like, well, could it be that if we write down the right Hamiltonian, we could get a self-correcting three-dimensional phase? Okay. So I will leave it there.